Jenna, who is graciously filling in for the, we'll call it vacationing Tom. I was going to say special assignment, but let's
that
be real here.
That is not a special assignment.
Okay. Well, it's very special.
To him.
My guest today from MinPost, minpost.com, David Brower. David, welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be on.
Pleasure to have you here. Two things I got to bring up before we get into this. Number one, about 4 or 5 years ago, I got an email and it said, you got to check out this guy's blog. He mentioned your website. And my website at the time, I think, might have had 4 videos and maybe 3 hits on it. I had this video. I thought, wouldn't it be fun to put old news on a website, which sounds really kooky when you think about it, but somehow it's worked. And the gentleman next to me decided to watch this whole video, which so only me and him had actually watched it at that point, and put this online, and I appreciated that, and we've been having dialogue since then. Second thing is, I have to ask you, what is your favorite toy technology?
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, Tom, just a few years, and my favorite toy technology, and it was a powerful technology at the time, was the light bulb.
There you go.
There were two. I think the first thing everybody will think of, who's still around, will think of the if they're thinking of this at all, is the original Easy Bake Oven. People don't realize that the original Easy Bake Oven, that was the
light
heating
bulb,
element,
light bulb heat.
The incandescent light bulb.
You
that's why it gave off so much heat, right? That's why we're getting rid of it now. No. It was so staggeringly inefficient.
Now, did Congress
that it could cook things in a small like box? But my favorite use of it, and this is one fewer people remember because it goes back a little further. It was a more obscure toy, but it's a great one if you can ever find it. It was a toy called photoelectric football. Do either of you, does that register with either of you?
I want to say that I've heard of that.
Okay, so here's basically what it was. It was a shoebox with a light bulb inside of it. And then, like, a piece of translucent paper, think like wax paper or something,
sure,
in the top. And what you did is you had these other pieces of translucent paper sort of in a paper frame that would slide in to an opening on the top of the photoelectric football box. One person would slide the offense on the translucent sheet of paper. The other would slide the defense. And then you would pull it back, and there was, like, a jagged arrow that would go through the play and – you know, if there was a defensive guy blocking the arrow, the play was over. But if it wasn't, you could score on the play. And it was just, I mean, to this day, it had the best, by the way, it had the best cardboard scoreboard of any sports game I've ever seen. But it was such, it's like, who thought of this?
There is an 11-minute video on YouTube, someone
genius,
actually taking it out of the box and showing how it works right
it's,
here. So
it was like, it had to be, for me, it was probably the mid to late 60s. But just, I mean, you think about the iPad, which, by the way, the top of the iPad, like if you lay it on a table, mm-hmm, looks like the top of photoelectric football.
Is there an app for photoelectric football?
There should be an app for
David,
photoelectric football. This is a million-dollar idea right there.
Oh my gosh.
Take it and go with it today.
Somebody out there.
David, you've done every media format, I think, out there. You've done TV,
yes,
radio,
mm-hmm,
newsprint,
yep,
internet.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about your background. You're from Iowa, correct?
I was actually born on Long Island, but before, just when I was in kindergarten, my dad got transferred out to Des Moines, Iowa, which is where I grew up. I lived till I was 19. I had an uncle who was a teacher at the University of Minnesota. I had originally left and went to college in Rochester, New York, but it was too expensive and I didn't like it. So I dropped out, moved back to Iowa, and then eventually came to the University of Minnesota because I wanted to go to a school in a big city with a good university that was public so that I could afford it.
And you want to be a journalist? Is that what you want to be set up to be?
You know, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be a journalist. I was the little kid on the block that had the at that time it was probably mimeographed or something, made a little newspaper, the
sure,
block newspaper, and tried to sell it for 5 cents.
Press hat with the press card in there.
People didn't
sure,
care. Yeah, I took the tour of the Des Moines Register, the whole deal. So when I came up here, I actually didn't go to journalism school. I went for political science, but I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And so one of the other reasons I came up here is that I could work my way through school. At the time, U was a place that didn't really require you to go full time,
right.
And so I went very part time. But I waited tables with a guy named David Carr.
Carr, that name rings a bell.
Yeah, if you follow the media, he's now a famous media columnist for the New York Times. But at the time, he was just a lowly waiter, and I was just a lowly waiter at the Anchorage restaurant in Northeast Minneapolis. I think it's a Sheraton now, and David had actually written a story on police brutality that he wanted to submit to the old Twin Cities Reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped edit it before he turned it into a real editor. And so he ended up getting hired. I was still pissing around, waiting tables, and eventually David said, "Come on, knucklehead! You know you gotta get off your butt, and you're good enough. You can do this." And actually got me a freelance job as the second string movie reviewer to Brian Lambert, who was the editor of the Reader at the time. Brian now writes for MinPost, but you know had edited there and worked for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. A whole.
Now, did you actually like any movies? Because Brian likes no movies. That's the.
Well, here's the deal with Brian. Brian's whole deal with that gig was to get on movie junkets.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I'm sure they still do them, but I think they've cut way back. At the time, this would have been the early 80s. They were fantastic and fantastically corrupt. I mean, basically, what would happen is movie studios would fly critics from the big dailies all the way down to somewhat obscure weeklies like the Twin Cities Reader out to some fabulous place, usually. It would be L.A., and they put you up in a great hotel. You'd fly first class. They would feed you fantastically. You would do these one-on-one or, depending on how big you were, group interviews with the stars, and you'd go back and you'd write a piece saying, you know, this crappy movie really isn't so bad after all. So it was totally corrupt.
That with Scott Baio actually is the top 10 movie of the year.
The all-timer for me, I eventually got to the point where I took a few of these junkets. So when I write about media corruption, I almost know whereof I speak. But the best one I ever got was to London. They flew me to London for a movie called Bird on a Wire.
With Goldie Hawn.
Goldie Hawn and Mel Gibson, exactly.
Wow.
Which, by the way, not a good movie. Not a good movie.
I think it's going to be playing on one of the higher channels at 4 in the afternoon,
exactly.
probably.
But it was my chance to, you know, meet Mel Gibson, who was a super hot, Nova's hot star at the time. This was when he'd sort of broken big. And
he wasn't ranting or raving at that point, was he?
No, you know, what I remember about Mel Gibson, first of all, was that he was actually a very charming guy, and he was in the process of quitting smoking.
Well,
and so he came into the interview and he said, "I'm sorry, I sounded a little rough this morning. I coughed up an oyster this morning. I'm quitting smoking."
Maybe Mel should have kept smoking if you know what it comes down to.
We can hope Mel was telling the truth about the quitting smoking part. So anyway, that was the beginning of my journalism career. And then along the way, I was still in college. David actually got me a gig as an assignment editor at CARE 11, which was WUSA Gannett at the time. I did that for 8 months. I helped the investigative team, a very lazy investigative journalist whose name I won't mention was working their time, no longer in the market, hasn't been checked his stocks more often than he checked his stories, but I helped him with a pull tab story of all things, and so they liked me and they put me on the assignment desk. I didn't like managing TV reporters. There's mm-hmm. there's no small amount of ego there, and I had an ego of my own, and so it was like I don't want to be on camera, but I want to have a byline. So that spurred me to kind of get on with my career and do more work at the Reader. I did some work at the Minnesota Daily actually long after I left school to get more work, and then eventually worked my way into a full-time job at the Reader, which is how my career got started.
You are forgetting one thing, though. You're forgetting one of the greatest TV programs that you contributed to in 1984.
Ah, and, I know it. The facts as we know them.
Let's listen to this. This is a great theme song.
Hello, welcome to The Facts as We Know Them, our periodic look at the news and what it might or might not mean. Brian Lambert's the regular host, but I think he's out handling the Save the Siberian Tiger campaign or checking with his parole officer, so he's not around tonight. Eric Eskel is my name from WCCO Radio. I'm the moderator, and hope you'll stay with us for about a half an hour. We kick around some topics with our panel of guest experts, including David Brower, Simon Editor at Channel 11, WTCN Television. The lovely and talented David Carr from the Twin Cities Reader, dressed to kill tonight.
Thank you.
And Dane Smith from the St. Paul of Pioneer Press. So last time Dane was with us,
he
was
quite a group.
It really was. I mean, Brian Brian was sort of the big tent pole of that, but Eric was had the broadest gig aside from Dane being at the Strib or at the Pioneer Press.
How new is cable was only what 6 months old at this point?
Because it was St. Paul Public Access, and Escala was, you know, I think years away from doing Almanac. So
right.
You're hearing him sort of before he got all of that experience. But it was a really good show. I mean, at the time there were, you know, literally three channels on and just a few cable channels devoted to news, and there wasn't a lot of place for reporters to talk about local news. It really wasn't.
Well, the best topic of this, and my guest today, David Brower, best part is the topic of this day was the 84 primaries just started in 84, and Walter Mondale was running against Gary Hart. I've got to say, this panel was convinced that Walter Mondale was done. I mean, he had his shot. It was done. Let's just take a listen of Brower with his esteemed panelist here.
Make any news coverage.
Walter,
and the next night he gave the same speech, and it was flat as a pancake.
Walter didn't get the press coverage. Walter was screwed by the media, I think, was the bottom line.
Well, I don't know. It seemed... Let's talk about what's going to happen.
Fritz.
Let's hear what happens with Mondale. Here's where I'm going to make some startling comments.
Startling.
I think Hart...
Could we review last week's?
Yeah,
just
I picked John Glenn second in New Hampshire, and I was a couple weeks
close. Early. Close.
Yes. Who did you pick first, Eric?
I remember direct quote.
Native Son won.
Being the only person in the real print media here.
Yeah.
I think he
Pardon
said...
Pardon me, sir.
What did I say?
I think he said something like, Mondale wins big.
Oh, I don't think I said
yes,
that.
Yes, I think he said something.
Say that. And then he went on to...
If you want to listen to that whole show, it is great. It's at tcmedianow.com, facts as we know them. I have to add more of those because our mutual friend Brian Lambert gave me a few tapes of those. I might have to put some more on very soon.
They are pretty good. I mean, you know, we were obviously as accurate as pundits still are today, but really a lot of talent in those chairs at a fairly young age. So if you want to look at bad clothes and thinner people and higher reedy voices, that's the way to go.
The best part about it for me is I'm looking at a group of people that probably got paid nothing to go to cable access and do this. And similar to what people say, well, why do you do blogs and why do people do this? You do it because you like doing it. And
it's fun.
If someone sees it and someone enjoys it and you're with a group of people, like-minded people that are talking about the topics you like, I think it's great.
Well, and let's be honest. I mean, some of these people, you know, we know what Eric Escala went on to do. David Carr went on to basically be the star of Page One. And I certainly wasn't thinking about this at the time because I really had no interest in being in front of the camera. But, you know, for a lot of people, it was a chance to gain some experience. But fundamentally, you're right. We all really enjoyed each other, and we enjoyed, like reporters do in newsrooms forever, we just enjoyed batting around the news and trying to figure out what was going on.
So you went on for the Reader, and then you did some radio. You did radio at... KFAN, and then you were the morning guy at KSTP for a while.
Yeah, this is sort of mind-boggling if you think about it today. It was at the time, too. But I had worked for the Reader, and then the only time in my journalism career I got fired because I wanted the managing editor's job. They ended up hiring an AP reporter from out of town, which I thought was outrageous since, you know, I always felt like the weeklies kind of looked down at themselves, and if anybody was from a daily background, they were somehow better. Well, this guy wasn't, and I didn't really hide my feelings, so they ended up pitching me out the door, which was probably the right thing to do. The next week, I started working for City Pages and as a freelancer, and ended up making more money my first year freelancing than I made as a staffer at the Twin Cities Reader. So I kind of learned, hey, you know, volume selling is best. But the price of that was that after a few years, 3 or 4 years, really working my butt off, I was getting burned out. Mm-hmm. And I had some friends from doing gigs like this. One of them was a guy named Mark Ginther, who was a producer at WCCO. He's out at one of the Seattle TV stations now. And he needed a fill-in guy for a guy who used to be on this station, Bob Yates.
That's right.
And Bob was a host, one of the best radio talents ever in this market, although a very prickly guy too. Hard to handle, Bob. He was a ticking time bomb, but brilliant, smart, just a radio natural. And he was on this sports station on KFAN when it was in its very early years. And so
he'd been fired from KSHP, then he went to KFAN.
Right, and I think it might not have been the first time he was fired either. But they needed to find a fill-in host who could talk about sports but wasn't stuck talking about sports, because they had to kind of appeal to that eclectic, wide-ranging thing that Bob had. And so Mark drafted me. Now, I'm I have one half of 1% of the radio talent that Bob Yates has. But, you know, I did what fill-ins do, which is filled in and apparently filled some air. So long story short, they end up firing Bob, and they need a substitute. They need somebody to come in and just be the host for 2 or 3 weeks till they figure out what they're doing. And so they called me in, and I did it. And it was something I could do early in the morning before I had to be a real reporter.
Right.
And after 2 or 3 weeks, they said, you know, this is working out okay.
Yeah, we stick around.
Like would you like to keep doing this? And as I recall, the money was pretty good for filling in. So I said, yeah. And eventually it got to the point where they offered me the job, and I said, you know, it'd be nice to not write for a few months or years. Just let that part of your brain heal.
And then at 10 o'clock, you go home, and you're done.
Yeah,
you're
although prepping. Waking up, my big mistake, and I made so many mistakes in morning radio, and one of the big ones I made was being a news guy, I overprepared. So I would be getting up at like 2 in the morning to, you know, read the newspapers or see what – there was an online then, and it was very clunky to get online. I remember giving out my email address on KFAN in 1994 or 95, and Chad Hartman and Dan Barrero just laughed at me. They thought it was the geekiest, nerdiest thing in the world. Of course, now that's their stock in trade. So I was working 6 days a week and getting up early, and Mark had since left and went to KSTP, which was then the conservative talk station, Rush Limbaugh's station.
And
all
was for a long time.
Long time. And but Tom Bernard then, as now, although to a less extent, was the dominant personality in morning. So pretty much anything you did in morning that wasn't on KQ was almost a waste of time. And they had fired Jesse Ventura. They had, because his ratings had slipped quite a bit, they brought in Nick Coleman just for sort of the same basis they brought me in for Bob Yates as sort of a bridge, a fill-in. And Mark said, come on over here, we'll pay you more money, and you'll only have to work 5 days a week. You only have to work Monday through Friday. You won't have to do Saturday. And I said,
done.
Done. Of course, I'm a liberal, and talking to KSTP's audience, which is very conservative, was an experience. My favorite part of that was that every morning, you know, we had the engineer, the board op had a fax machine because that was the technology of the time, the light bulb of the in the shoebox of the time. And every morning that I was on the air at KSTP, this fax would come clattering over, you know, let's say 7 o'clock in the morning, and all it said on it was Brower is a banana head.
I have to ask a question. Understanding your politics just from reading and understanding that we all have different points of view.
Yep.
What was management thinking? Like we have a conservative base from 9 a.m. to, I guess, Tom Mischke. He was pretty apolitical. But what was the thought? Was the liberals were going to turn on, or they actually were going to be able to bridge that gap between right and left, or the right would just be calling up and yelling at you for 4 hours? What was the thought process behind that?
My theory on it, I enjoyed working for the Hubbards. It's the only time I did, and they actually treated me very, very well. Were very supportive. I left on my terms because even though my ratings were never great, my son was born, and I'd gotten up even earlier for that show because I wanted to prepare even more to defend myself, if nothing else. So it just got to be burnout of a different kind. I think what they were thinking was Bernard's conservative. That's locked up. Let's just try a long bomb. It might work. It might not. But let's just try something completely different. The other thing, and I appreciated them seeing this because I probably thought from the outside at the time that every Hubbard person was super conservative, you know, from the old man on down to the lowliest staffer. And it really wasn't that way. I think they thought that as time went on, I would actually either be less political or develop enough talent where I could talk about a number of things. Mm-hmm. And so it would be a less stridently political show and more of a sort of a thoughtful, eclectic, entertaining show. And they were like I said, they were nothing but supportive. And like I went into them a few times after seeing the ratings and said, you sure you want to keep doing this? Because if you're changing your mind, just let me know. And even to the very end, I worked there for a year and a half, they show no indication of that at all.
Very interesting. I think that sometimes a product and advertising revenue is going to drive a show. And I think that if you're a conservative owner or a liberal owner, hey, if your product can generate audience, generate buzz, it can be right, left, in between, or you know, what it is, and we'll keep it on the air.
Right. I mean, and that's something you see even today in the market. As a media reporter now, I certainly hear it in the market. We'll assume it's true for entertainment purposes.
But I understand the Hubbards, at least Jenny Morris, who runs the station now, she didn't like the conservative label on the station, for what I understood. She had all these conservative hosts, which in the 90s and 2000s were making tons of money for the station.
Right, but remember that Jenny, who was, again, fabulous to work for, she had Catherine Lanfer on KSTP, who is nobody's conservative.
Turi Ryder.
Turi Ryder was on there. So, yeah, and Mischke. So they really did want good talent. Now, at the very end with me, to help goose the ratings, they paired me up with a conservative, a guy by the name of Scott Korzenowski, who still fills in at AM 1500, who's actually a law clerk at the Minnesota Supreme Court with my wife. And that pairing didn't go well, not because Scott's a bad guy, but because that was when it started to get arguey and contentious. And again, I didn't blame them for doing it because we were trying things, but it was, you know, it made it a lot less fun.
We have to get a list someday of all the morning duos that have tried in this market, that have tried and failed.
On that station, man.
Well, that one especially.
You'd have a full page. I mean, really, in this market, especially talk, just because of the dominance of KQ, it's a long list.
I think John Woodley is my favorite one they tried for a while. John Woodley and Barbara Carlson two times.
Barbara was on after me for most of my time at KSTP, and what made that relationship interesting was that when I was at the Twin Cities Reader, Barbara was somebody I wrote about critically a lot. Barbara had a
very easy to also.
Barbara had a big rival at the time, the first openly gay, maybe elected official in Minnesota, maybe it was Alan Speer, but Brian Coyle was the first gay Minneapolis City Council member, and he and Barbara, for whatever reason, just were cats and dogs, and Brian was a good source of mine, so he had filled my notebook with a lot of interesting stuff that I could verify about Barbara. And Barbara was just, as anybody who remembers Barbara, she's still around, I saw her the other day, knows, you know, Barbara would overreact to any comment about her, even if it was, you know, pleasant. And so she was a great foil to write about, and she almost made her predicament worse. Well, she believe me, when we used to do the handoff at 9 o'clock, and she would always try to get her revenge on me, would always try to embarrass me and put me in a bad spot, which was fine. Fair is fair, but it made for some interesting moments.
Barbara makes a great video and audio. We need more Barbara on there. It is fantastic audio and video to watch and listen to.
Yeah, you know, it's like she's like a lot of radio talents that I've either worked with or watched, which is some real talent, some definite, like, indelible radio talent there. But would, if they could just 5% of them could just, that 5% of their being could actually take direction, could take comments or criticism from their bosses, they would be so much more awesome. The trouble is, I guess, you never really know which 5% you're supposed to take.
So. True enough. My guest, David Brower, today, this is Flashback Twin Cities. No, you're exactly right. And this is the 20th anniversary this year, 93, or, you know, 1993. Barbara Carlson hosted a debate for the mayors of St. Paul and Minneapolis. She asked bizarre questions. She asked questions that no debate moderator, I mean, we're used to debate moderators like Bob Schieffer, Jim Lehrer. So Barbara Carlson gives everyone signs to hold up and down. We thought the YouTube debate a few years ago was wacky. I'm going to put this up online in a few months when it's more closer to the mayor's race, but in the Good Company set, Barbara Carlson has 10 different mayoral candidates and starts asking them about their personal lives, their drug use, their legal issues. It makes for great video.
Yeah, that sounds totally like Barbara. I'll watch it when you put it up because, again, there is some real brilliance about Barbara and probably some things that she did differently that, especially at that time, needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But there was so much. And this is true for, like, all of us egotistical people. There's so much indulgence there that, you know, that's one of the reasons that you end up wearing poorly on an audience is that you get some success, and Barbara definitely had that. But over time, you start to indulge yourself, and you don't wear quite as well. You're not as authentic. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, one of the things, if I had it all to do all over again, is I was very self-critical of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the numbers backed it up. But I look back and I say I was too hard on myself, that I should have trusted myself more. I should have been more comfortable.
Relax,
in my
have
skin.
Fun, enjoy what you're
you
doing.
Know, or just follow your, you know, just believe that what you're doing is good and true. I had a different problem than most radio hosts had at the time. So, but you know, it was one of those things that it was like the facts as we know them. It was a great experience. It was it was doing something different, which I always enjoy doing. I change whatever I'm doing about every 4 years. And, you know, it helps you in other walks of life. You know, as I cover the media now for MinPost, you know, having been inside a lot of these operations, I have a little bit more insight
and
than somebody from the outside.
People still call you back, which is great, because a couple of your fellow columnists I know over the years, they almost isolate themselves by – it's tough to say. You need to be a critic. You need to be critical of what's going on. But if you isolate yourselves, if you're so harshly critical of everything they do, you end up isolating yourselves from all sources.
It's tricky because – The act of talking to people, which is a basic repertorial act and something I value and still do, it does sometimes get you in a position of being too sympathetic to the person that you're talking to. And so sometimes the idea is, well, to remain an outsider and to remain, you know, truly critical, and you've got to just follow your nose. But I agree. The downside is when you stop talking to people, when you start thinking everything begins and ends inside of your own head, I don't think you're a more effective journalist.
Let's take a break. My guest, David Brower, will come back, talk about MinPost and media in the digital age. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond, my guest, David Brower of MinPost, minpost.com. And we were talking about earlier in the show and then just now, I think the anger level when the weather's nice goes down. The sun's out. We're less angry. I think for about 6 weeks when it was snowing 2 inches every day, just a lot of angst. However, I read your column very faithfully. I read The Glean, read a lot of columnists and MinPost, some who maybe I would align with, some who I would not. I'm always amazed by the number of commentators that are on there within 5 minutes. There's commentators. Some of them are writing columns as long as you are writing, and there's some characters on there, much like talk radio, the same characters used to call up all the time. They have nicknames. You must find it very similar in the commentating world of especially the detractors. The detractors are the ones that are on there within 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's. I mean, obviously, I have commenters on my stuff. I don't know. You know, over the years, I think the hater quotient for my stuff has gone down. And I think part of the reason is that I am willing to engage just about anybody as long as they're dealing in good faith. I mean, if they start to get stupid or just mean-spirited or they just want their pound of flesh, then, you know, if they're on Twitter, I'll block them. And if their comments that are you know, just really off point, I'll delete them. But I think most – you know, the overwhelming majority of people who disagree with me, I'm actually genuinely interested in hearing about and responding to. And I think it's sort of who I am, but I think being in talk radio actually for 3 years made a big difference for me, because the thing I enjoyed the most about talk radio, aside from just getting to talk, was having conversations with people who thought differently than I do. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to get them to agree with you. It is helpful if you can see where each other's coming from. And some of the best discussions I had, I'll tell you a great story about callers in the radio context. When at the very end of my radio stint, when my wife was pregnant with our son Ian, I got a call off the air from a frequent commenter, a frequent caller to my show named Doug. And Doug said, "Hey, you know what? My wife, Maureen, is a doula." And I said, "Well, what's a doula? I don't have any idea what a doula is." He said, "Well, you know, she's basically a birth coach. She's not a nurse, not a doctor, but attends the pregnancy, and her number one responsibility is seeing to the well-being of the mother."
Right.
And I said, "Wow, this sounds cool." And so we met with Maureen. Couldn't be more different than me. I'm a completely sort of unchurched, a-religious, lefty person. Maureen was an evangelical, conservative, you know, Bible-based person. That was the reason that she was doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
She was inspired by the Bible. And it couldn't have been a more fantastic experience. When we had our daughter, Abigail, a few years later, Maureen was the doula. If couples out there, if any of you are pregnant and you haven't considered a doula, you should consider it a doula. That was the sort of human relationship that I got to experience from somebody on the other side just by being human back. And so I remember that. And over the years, I think it's really held me in good stead. Now, occasionally there's times when people on my side will say, well, you know, you're too open-minded or you're too passive. You know, you're too tolerant of people, and you should, you know, if they're wrong, you should say they're wrong, and maybe you're pulling your punches. And I think about that sometimes. But the truth is that a lot of these commenter battles, if you have the time, can be diffused just by engaging in the conversation. Where some of the anger comes from, not all, but some, is from people who just want to be heard.
Right.
And maybe they express themselves rageaholically or inarticulately in the beginning because they're just so anxious to be heard, whereas I am in a position where people hear me all the time, that if you have a little bit of empathy, sometimes you can really diffuse it and get to the issues. Now, I don't want to be, you know, Pollyannish about this and say, mm-hmm. kumbaya, everybody will love each other. I mean, there are real jerks out there, and they suck up a lot of your time, and it's harder for people who are in more major media than I am to truly engage all of their audience. But, yes, you do see the same people, and you say, what are you doing with your life? And a lot of people are retired, and they don't, you know, this is something that's important to them, and they actually have the time. There's other people who I think seriously need psychiatric help and really need to get treated, like, not in my news column.
There's a couple commentators. I'm not going to give their names out, but there's one on the right, one on the left, and I'm always fascinated that, first of all, and mostly it's the Glean, I think, that gets a lot of these kinds of comments.
Well, Brian can invite that. Brian's more political in his Glean even than I was when I did it.
Brian might be listening. You know, Brian does find a way to put a little left knife twist in any story. But I do like, though, that there's a commentator out there that I think he comments on every single MinnPost column out there. His word count is higher than most of the columns that he's commentating on, and I always wonder, does he have these things already kind of pre-typed up, and he's waiting to hit cut and paste?
It's just waiting to pour out of him or her. And we do have commenting guidelines at MinnPost. I want to say that too. When we delete a comment, it's not just because somebody's gored our ox. I mean, if it gets personal,
right,
mean-spirited, if it gets toward another, if it starts to be a commenter on commenter battle, we won't let those go through because it just gets stupid. There's a thing in internet discussions called hijacking the thread,
right?
And that can happen a lot if you let people go. And frankly, I think one of the weaknesses of MinnPost, maybe it shows that our reach isn't as far as it should be, is that I can recognize a lot of the commenters. I mean, I think it's more healthy if you're getting quality comments from a wide array of people. And so one of the reasons we have commenting guidelines and some moderation is to try to create not a safe space, but an open space for people who don't feel like they, you know, want to jump into a big bag of snakes.
Well, the best part is, you know, at tcmedianow.com, the website that a lot of these videos we've heard today can be viewed, I don't do a political website. I don't do politics on it. I want to be able to everyone to be able to laugh and enjoy
it's
history.
It's a shared history. Yeah, that makes sense.
And occasionally I'll get someone that'll put a comment on one of the videos and they want to skew it. And my comment is something similar to what Bob Yates said many years ago. You know, if you're really that good, why don't you just do your own you know, radio show? And the same thing with commentators is you can, you know, the blogger program is free on Google. You can do your own blog with all this great insight you have.
We've actually discovered some, we call it community voices, but it's like an op-ed at a newspaper. We've actually discovered some of those people via the comments and gotten them to write longer stuff for us. So you're right. It's the media is a lot more accessible now. You can be the media. Unfortunately, the fundamental dynamic that creates a lot of the rage here is that these people can be the media. Nobody will pay attention to them because of flaws that they can absolutely not see in themselves. They're always on offense.
Right.
And so, you know, whatever their psychological needs are to go out there and start punching, they got to do it. And I also just want to add really quickly, sometimes those punches are deserved. Sometimes I get comments from people who make really good points that I have to struggle a little bit to get to admit to myself.
Two things real quick. Number one, do you find it tough to disconnect sometimes? Do you find it tough to disconnect from all that's going out in the world and all the information?
Absolutely. 100%. I'm the worst disconnector ever.
You and I both. Number two, you're back in school now.
Yes.
Tell me about this.
Well, I've written three columns about this for MinnPost. It's pretty much all I've been writing lately, which isn't much. But My parents had thought that I graduated. I was two classes away from graduating in 1985 at the University of Minnesota. I never really set them straight because I was embarrassed.
I hope you didn't have a party and took checks from people for
absolutely.
Okay, good. So
I decided in my 53rd year that I was going to make it right. I wanted to make it right before they died, and also because I've actually lived a pretty good life. I've learned a lot about myself, and this was sort of the one thing that I really wasn't proud of. And it's actually nice to be in that position in life where you only have one thing that you're
right.
not really proud of. So I figured this is within my power to take care of it. I'm married to a wonderful woman, and she was encouraging on this, and it's been a fantastic experience. It's reminded me how great and wise 18-year-olds are. I mean, I thought that when I was 18, but I've just been super impressed with the students, especially at the U. What they lack in experience, they actually have inside in wisdom, and so I can sort of see that teacher's excitement a little bit in being able to bring out things about people that they don't even know themselves yet, or they aren't even sure about themselves yet.
So you're under the group projects yet, where you have to meet at when the students
projects.
Good,
I got the
good.
Term papers now, baby.
Okay,
and
I
do not like writing unless it's for money. So so this is going to be hard.
Now, how old is Sean?
He's 15, almost 16.
Okay, now. So he's not in school with you. That would be kind
no.
Of
I want to get done before he.
Okay,
I'm taking him on a tour of the university on Monday. He's a sophomore at Washburn High in South Minneapolis. So that'll be a weird experience.
This could have been a documentary. We could have got both Browards at school together.
I don't know if anybody would have watched that.
So what's what's next for for the MinnPost right now? It's online journalism. What's the next thing? Are we going to be able to keep TV, radio, and online? Is it all going to marry each other inconveniently at best? Is it going to work out?
I mean, I think it has merged, and to a great degree. And I think when we get to the point for radio, when we get to the point where the internet is in your car fully, mm-hmm. that's when that convergence is going to happen. When they stop putting AM and FM radios in cars, and it's all internet broadcast. That's when that changes.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a big change. For now, there are still platforms that people prefer, reading a print newspaper, for example, sitting down in front of a big screen. But for everything else that's content that can truly be converged, that's what we're going to see. And I think most media executives who have thought about this at all know that that's what's happening.
A lot of late reactors. I think that the traditional media reacted very late to all this.
Well, at least a decade late. But you also have to be a little sympathetic, because it's been such a tremendous change to their revenue models
mm-hmm.
that to have jumped early actually would have cost them a lot of money with an uncertain revenue gain. I mean, it's really unclear how much legacy media organizations can change, especially if they're in the news business, and still be able to afford the fundamental thing that they're supposed to do.
They'll be around. My guest, David Brower, thank you so much for being on today. This is Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osmond. We'll be back next Saturday. Till then, so long.